It is a real pleasure for me to join you this afternoon. I'm grateful to you for inviting me to speak. I want to talk about the role of the courts in the protection and vindication of civil liberties and rights. There has always been a role for the courts to provide protection for the citizen through the common law, and the process by which this operated was described by Lord Gough in a case called Clangwood Benson against Lincoln City Council, and he said, "When a judge decides a case which comes before him, he does so on the basis of what he understands the law to be. This he discovers from the applicable statutes, if any, and from precedents drawn from reports of previous judicial decisions. In the course of deciding the case before him, he may on occasion develop the common law in the perceived interests of justice, though as a general rule he does this only interstitially. That means not only that he must act within the confines of the doctrine of precedent, but that the change so made must be seen as a development, usually a very modest development of existing principle, and so can take place as a congruent part of the common law as a whole. In this process, what Maitland has called the seamless web, Lord Gough called the mosaic of the common law, is kept in a constant state of adaptation and repair, the doctrine of precedent and the cement of legal principle providing the necessary stability." Although the Supreme Court has recently reminded us of the important role of the common law in the protection of rights and liberties in the case called Osborne, the efficacy of the protection secured by the common law has been the subject of stringent criticism from time to time. In a blog entitled On Fantasy Island, British Politics, English Judges and European Convention on Human Rights, Professor Conor Geardy recently suggested that at certain times the judiciary had thrown the necessary constitutional camouflage over successive exercises of raw state violence. It is not necessary for me to enter into a polemical consideration of the validity of that contention, which in any event is cast against a historical background. But of more significance is the analysis of victims' rights contained in an article in last month's Criminal Law Review by Sir Keir Starmer. His analysis was that while the common law traditionally secured protection from unwarranted interference with the exercise of freedoms, it was much less adaptable in promoting and securing positive rights. Although I would not accept that such an analysis was universally true, I do acknowledge that the introduction into domestic law of the Human Rights Act has given rise to positive rights for victims and prisoners in the criminal sphere, and within the social sphere has secured rights for vulnerable and disabled members of society and those minorities within society who have been marginalised and in some cases excluded. When I talk about human rights, it is of course important to make clear the context for the exercise of such rights. There is sometimes a tendency to see human rights as absolute and therefore unconnected to the interests of the community or others within the community. There are some absolute rights, such as the right to life, but most human rights are qualified rights, and it seems to me that the function of the court in relation to such rights is to ensure respect for the right in question. That will often require the court to balance the right against the interests and rights of others and to analyse the responsibilities attaching to all of those who may wish to exercise rights. And it is particularly where there is a balance to be struck between rights that the exercise of responsibility becomes important. The introduction into domestic law of the Human Rights Act has led to the courts increasingly becoming a battleground for the vindication of social and political rights. That has certainly happened in this jurisdiction, but it is not unique. It reflects changes in scientific, social and cultural conditions with which the legislature has difficulty keeping in touch. The recent Supreme Court judgment in Ireland regarding the complex social issue of surrogacy shows the discomfort the courts have in being put in a situation where the state has failed to regulate. In that case, a couple wished to have children, but the wife suffered from a medical condition which meant that she could not carry a pregnancy. Her sister agreed to act as a surrogate mother. IVF treatment was arranged to stimulate the wife's ova and fertilise with the husband's. conceived, which was then carried by its sister. After the birth, the husband and wife sought to register themselves as the mother and father of the child. Beware, it was argued, the genetic parents, although the sister who supported the application actually gave birth to the child. The High Court supported the application of the husband and wife to be registered, but the Supreme Court allowed the appeal on the basis that this was a matter of social policy for the legislature. Mr. Justice Hardiman quoted with approval the following passage from an earlier decision. I am of the opinion that the suggested radical change in the hitherto accepted law should more properly be effected by statute. The public policy which a new formulation of the law would represent should more properly be defined by the Law Reform Commission or by those others who are in a position to take a broad perspective as distinct from what is discernible to the tunnel vision imposed by the facts of a single case. And I think there's a lot to be said for the judiciary stopping to recognise that they deal with matters on a case-by-case basis rather than having the advantage of the broad consultative process that legislation normally requires. Other judges repeatedly bemoaned the absence of laws to guide them. They describe a legal half-world that cries out for legislation, a world where couples struggling with the pain of infertility face the prospect of having to become a vociferous pressure group to agitate for a proper legal regime. The United Kingdom's constitutional structure is different in that much greater emphasis is placed on the supremacy of the Westminster Parliament. One might think that it followed that greater caution would be exercised before stepping into territory occupied by the legislature. Recent case law may, however, suggest otherwise. Nicholson was a case which dealt with the difficult and significant issue of assisted suicide. The case concerned the question whether the present state of the law of England and Wales relating to assisted suicide infringes the European Convention on Human Rights, and whether the courts could step in and take a hold of the reins when Parliament refused to do so in order to protect the applicant's rights. The Supreme Court unanimously held that the question whether the current law was incompatible with Article 8 of the Convention, which protects the right to private life, lay within the United Kingdom's margin of appreciation and was therefore a matter for the United Kingdom to decide. Five of the justices held that the court had the constitutional authority to make a declaration that the general prohibition on assisted suicide was incompatible with Article 8. Of those five, Lord Neuberger, Ass and Wilson declined to grant a declaration of incompatibility in the case, but Lady Hale and my immediate predecessor, Lord Kerr, would have done so. Four of the justices concluded that the question whether the law was compatible with Article 8 involved a consideration of issues which Parliament was inherently better qualified than the courts to assess, and that the courts should respect Parliament's assessment. In considering the question whether it was institutionally appropriate for a domestic court to consider whether Section 2 of the Suicide Act 1961 was incompatible with Article 8, Lord Newbury, the President of the Court, said, quite apart from the points already made, the mere fact that there are moral issues involved plainly does not mean that the courts need to keep out. Even before the 1998 Act came into force, the courts were prepared to make decisions which developed the law and involved making moral choices of this type. In Re B, which was concerned with worship, and J, Land and F, which were all concerned with life support machines, and the conjoined twins case, which was recently heard, they were all decided before the 1998 Act was in force, and each decision would have been treated as involving a wrong moral choice by some people. Further, in re-read treatment, the court was prepared to decide an action that should be taken which would end a person's life because that person wanted that action to be taken. Although, of course, it should not have been necessary to go to court to give effect to these wishes unless there was some concern over the mental capacity of the patient or some other special reason. Thus, the courts have been ready to assume responsibility for developing the law on what are literally life and death issues, and then to shoulder responsibility for implementing the law as so developed. It is perhaps worth noting in the present context that despite pleas from judges, Parliament has not sought to resolve these questions through statutes, but has been content to leave them to be worked out by the courts. End of the quote. The principle of parliamentary sovereignty does not, of course, apply to the local assembly. The precise relationship between the court and the local legislature was examined by the Supreme Court in the Accident Insurance case. It is clear, however, that on issues of controversial social policy, individuals and groups in Northern Ireland who seek to achieve change are looking more and more towards the courts as a mechanism for debating matters that would in the past have been considered purely political. Sometimes that is a mechanism by which it is sought to reverse a decision made by the executive, but there are also many examples of issues being raised in the courts where the legislature or executive have been unwilling to make forward proposals or to give guidance. The family planning case and the same-sex adoption case are recent examples in Northern Ireland where courts are now carrying out an important constitutional function of striking the balance between executive action and individual rights where there is a dispute. That inevitably raises issues about the manner in which the views of the executive arm of government should be respected. Bank Mellon against the Treasury was a Supreme Court case which arose out of government decisions in the conduct of foreign policy concerning sanctions imposed on a bank in connection with the prevention of nuclear proliferation in Iran. The majority and the minority were agreed that the judgment of the executive was in principle entitled to considerable weight, and in the majority judgment was put in this way. None of this means that the court is to take over the function of the decision maker, least of all in a case like this one. As Maurice Kay, LJ, observed in the Court of Appeal, this case lies in the area of foreign policy and national security, which would once have been regarded as unsuitable for judicial scrutiny. Interesting that things have moved on there. The measures have been opened up to judicial scrutiny by the express terms of the Act, because they may engage the rights of designated persons or others under the European Convention of Human Rights. Even so, any assessment of the rationality and proportionality of the Schedule 7 direction must recognise that the nature of the issue requires the Treasury to be allowed a little margin of judgment. It is difficult to think of a public interest as important as nuclear non-proliferation. The question whether some measure is apt to limit the risk posed for the national interest by nuclear proliferation in a foreign country depends on an experienced judgment the international implications of a wide range of information, some of which may be secret. This is preeminently a matter for the executive. For my part, I wholly endorse the view of Lord Reid that the making of government and legislative policy can't be turned into a judicial process. All of this shows that the work of the judiciary in the protection and vindication of rights has changed dramatically in the last 15 years. I want to return to a theme I developed in a lecture I gave to the Human Rights Group of the Law Society of Ireland in 2012 entitled Finding the Equilibrium. The Human Rights Act has imposed responsibilities on the judiciary to strike the balance between the individual and the state in matters of social policy, crime, and national security. We have seen a number of examples. Striking that balance will be achieved by the characteristic common law method, which is to evolve a response over time in a back and forth discussion between the legislature, judiciary and ministers. It is by means of that conversation that a new equilibrium can be found to meet the social challenge. At times, the conversation may seem messy and even tempered, but the long view shows that panic is misplaced. With patience and good faith, a new equilibrium will be found. It is important to remember that in Northern Ireland, the devolved institutions have only recently returned. In particular, justice has only been devolved since April 2010. We are a new democracy in that sense. In terms of the Human Rights Act, all devolved legislation is secondary legislation. That means that the Assembly is prohibited from making any legislation which does not comply with the Human Rights Act, and the courts can effectively strike it down if they do. There is therefore a need to ensure judges and politicians understand what their respective roles are and that each respect of the areas reserved to the others. This is likely to create a degree of difficulty from time to time, but I think it right to report that I have found a genuine concern among our elected politicians to respect those boundaries and a genuine willingness to engage in a fruitful conversation. The judiciary, as I often say, is independent, but it is not isolated. We participate and we listen willingly to the other voices in the conversation. For my part, I will do all that I can to ensure that the difficult issues we face as we establish our evolved justice institutions are determined in an atmosphere of mutual respect.